Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, Chapter 5. Rogers in the Moving Pictures. Will Rogers was a stage star of the first magnitude when Samuel Goldwyn, the producer, persuaded him to quit Broadway to go into the movie pictures in 1919. The plays were far from being startling successes, but Goldwyn, with his uncanny sense of showmanship that boosted him to the top, realized that as a movie star, Rogers possessed a homely quality that would appeal to the masses. Goldwyn was ahead of his time, for the silent films could not reproduce the inimitable drawl with that multitude of inflections. To star in the movies at that time, the actor had to captivate the younger generation by his looks, and the cowboy philosopher, who looked as if he had just finished cutting his own hair with a pair of dull sheep shears, could not display his great personality to the best advantage. Early days in the movies. Rogers was asked in those early days how he happened to enter the films, and he replied, "When Goldwyn decided to make fewer and worse pictures, he sent for me." It was Rex Beach, brother-in-law of Fred Stone, who introduced Rogers to Goldwyn. Beach told the picture producer that Will was the man to play the part of Bill Hyde, hero of Beach's novel, which was being adapted for the screen by Goldwyn. On the screen, the picture became Laughing Billy Hyde, and Rogers played the title role. Rogers' own version of how he was approached on the subject of entering the moving pictures is a masterpiece of wit. "I've knocked all around the world," he said. "I was born in the old Indian territory, and I grew up on a cow pony, but I prefer to travel in a Pullman. I can shoot pretty straight, but I've got no notches in my gun. I never even shot up an ice cream parlor or a cigar store. Most of the Wild West stuff is pulled off in the big cities anyway. I didn't have any more intention of going into pictures than I had of being president of Yale. I was living quiet and peaceful down in Amityville, Long Island, where the insane asylum is, when Mrs. Rex Beach came driving down there one day. She steps out of her royalty on the spoilers and says, 'Will, you're going into the movies.' I pointed over to the place where they kept the lunatics and told her chauffeur that she had come to the wrong place. 'No, Will, I'm serious,' Mrs. Beach says. I told her my hair wasn't curly, that I couldn't roll a cigarette with one hand, and that I didn't aim to annoy more than one audience at a time. 'You've got to come, Will,' she insisted. 'The movies is the third biggest business in the world. Safety razors is first, corn plasters second, and movies third.' Well, I went in. Since then, the movies has become the second biggest business in the country. Bootlegging is the biggest. The movies is the grandest show business I know anything about. It's the only place where an actor can act and at the same time sit down in front and clap for himself." Rogers told Goldwyn that he couldn't act, and when the producer offered him a contract, he replied, "You're waving that paper at the wrong boy, Mr. Goldwyn. Why, if I was to take up your proposition, you'd be the maddest man in the world before you got through with me." Laughing Bill Hyde was produced at the Goldwyn Studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and the picture made money for the producer, but nothing like the fabulous sums that were to pour into the coffers of the Fox Company when Rogers appeared in the talking pictures. After the first picture was finished, Goldwyn took Rogers to see it one day and said, "Now what do you say, Mr. Rogers? Are you an actor?" "Yep," replied Rogers. "You're right. I am an actor, all right. The worst in the world. My answer is still the same. Leaving the acting business to them that can act. All I know how to do is to throw a lariat and crack jokes." Rogers' estimate of himself was always modest in the extreme. He frequently told fellow actors that he could not act, and the only time he was any good was when they found a part that's sort of like me. He expressed a similar opinion of his skill with the lariat. "I'm the poorest roper in the world." But that was Rogers. As an actor, he essayed many roles and performed them with a rare skill that others could not imitate. As a roper, he was one of the best that ever appeared on the stage. In 1920, Rogers made Jubileo and Goldwyn always was of the opinion that this film was the Oklahoman's greatest achievement in silent pictures. It was a melodrama in which Rogers played the part of a forlorn old tramp. Motion picture critics of the period accorded the film only casual notice, and the same was true of other films of the day. Regardless of the opinion of the critics, Goldwyn continued to star Rogers in silent films. They must have made him some money by proving popular with the movie fans of the day, for no producer would have featured a player in one film after another unless he brought in box office receipts. Among the silent pictures in which Rogers starred in were Almost a Husband, Honest Hutch, Jess, Call Me Jim, Two Wagons, Both Covered, Doubled for Romeo, Boys Will Be Boys, Family Fits, Our Congressman, The Headless Horseman, Going to Congress, Gee Whiz, Genevieve, and A Texas Steer. In those early days on the movie lot, an assistant director told Rogers that he would have to ride a horse in one of the scenes. The assistant then went on to explain that if he couldn't ride, a double would be provided for him. Will looked at the young man quizzically and asked, "Where's the horse?" On being shown the animal, Rogers leaped upon the back and cut across the lot in good old cowboy fashion. The assistant director, who had made the mistake of thinking Will was strictly a Broadway cowboy, stood open-mouthed as Rogers put the horse through his paces. Writes his own titles. In a film travelogue entitled In Paris, in which Rogers appeared in those days, the titles were written by him. Without the picture, the effect of many of them was lost, but some of the others were amusing by themselves. They were, "Well, folks, here we all are in gay Paris, but count on the French custom of throwing rocks at American tourists, I'm going to disguise myself as a frog." Will then put on a small, pointed black mustache. "Now, if your sightseers will all keep still and don't start bragging about where you come from, they'll never know we're Americans. Come on, folks, crawl into the Limberjack hack, and I'll show you the Claymore, Oklahoma of France. First, I'll show you the most thrilling spot in Paris, the place where Americans go every day to see if their friends back home have cabled the money. Here's the French Opera. If this was in America, it would be a movie house. This chateau on the right is the Café de la Paix, and if you are an American, you will. These saloons are so full, half the people can't get in, so they set them on the sidewalk. The Grand Boulevard, translated into Oklahoma English, it means main stem. Here's the Eiffel Tower. Charlie Schwab sold them the steel. Otis put in the elevators, and the Americans go up and look. It's a traffic tower for angels and airplanes. They call this the Latin Quarter because no one speaks Latin and no one has a quarter. These are the Tuileries, the most beautiful gardens. That thing spouting out is a fountain. If a thing was spouting at home, it would be a senator. The French have done very well with their art when you consider they use only two subjects, the nude woman and the lion, and even the lion is nude. This is the Louvre, France's great picture gallery. It's the nearest thing France has to our Hollywood. The Louvre has more art, but Hollywood has more excitement. Let me present Mona Lisa, the only beauty who went through history and retained her reputation. Return to the stage. After 3 years before the camera, Rogers became convinced that the stage offered him the most medium of expression, and he returned to the New Amsterdam roof, where he opened his new act in a masked dance in which he impersonated a showgirl in the Ziegfeld Frolic. He wore a pair of pink satin slippers and a cape in his impersonation, but he presented the act only once in public. "I wore the pink satin slippers just once, and that was enough," Rogers said. "Besides, I think it was silly, even if people did laugh when I threw off my cloak." To fellow actors, Will confessed that he was glad to get away from the movie lots and return to the theater. "It's a great thing," he said, "to get the old brain working again after loafing on the movie lots. You know, you've got to exercise your brain just like your muscles. I found when I went back that I wasn't as good as I used to be. I was all out of practice." First talkie. When sound projection proved successful, Winfield F. Sheehan then executive head of Fox Films, sought his bosom friend, Will Rogers, and persuaded him to return to take a chance on the talkies. "Ah, Winnie," protested Will, "I'll probably mess your picture all up." But Sheehan was of a different opinion, and Rogers went to Hollywood to make They Had to See Paris, which was produced in 1929. The picture registered as a smash hit throughout the country and immediately established Rogers as the leading box office attraction. Fox made about $700,000 profit on the picture, and Will's contract called for the production of another picture immediately. Before it was started, however, Fred Stone cracked up in his airplane. Rogers chartered an airplane and flew to New York to take his friend's part so that the show might go on. Aside from his great friendship for Stone, it was said that Rogers was motivated by the thought that more than 100 persons, actors, showgirls, and stage artisans would be thrown out of work unless the show went on. Three Cheers had a long run, and then one day Will Rogers faced the difficult task of playing Fred Stone while the veteran comedian was in the audience. Late in 1930, Rogers went back to Hollywood. The first picture he made on his return to Hollywood was So This Is London, and one of the uproarious bits occurs when Rogers is playing the role of a seasick passenger crossing the Atlantic Ocean. He was wrapped in blankets and seated in a steamer chair when a dizzy young thing noticed his misery and inquired airily, "Is this your first crossing?" Rogers looked up at her wanly from the depths of his coverings and replied, "Does anyone ever go again?" In famous roles. His next appearance on the talking screen was in the role of Bill in Lightnin', the character made famous by Frank Bacon on the legitimate stage. As Bill Jones, the lovable old inventor, Rogers had a part that in many ways was like himself. Bill, however, was a shiftless husband, and by no stretch of the imagination could Will Rogers have been found guilty on that score in real life, even in the smallest degree. In The Connecticut Yankee, a modernization and adaptation of Mark Twain's famous tale, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Rogers was a radio engineer who was transported back to the days of the Knights of the Round Table after being stunned by an electrical outburst in a gigantic and mysterious radio set. In Mark Twain's original version, the first Yankee was carried back to King Arthur's time after being hit over the head in a fight with a fellow worker. In the filming of the picture, the question arose whether Will Rogers could be induced to wear tights. It was said that he objected in the beginning, and in the early scenes he wore his conventional blue overalls. Even in the jousting scene, when he might have been expected to appear like other knights, he insisted upon a costume of his own design, and it did not include tights. Near the end of the picture, when Will donned armor to go out and rescue the pretty princess from the wicked queen, he capitulated. When his captors denuded him of his iron shirt and pants, Rogers stood clad in tights. In the picture Young as You Feel, Rogers showed that he could not only wear clothes as well as any other great actor, but that he could play parts that were decidedly unlike himself in real life. Appearing first as the groaning dyspeptic who had set time by the punctuality with which he takes his pills, Rogers, as Lemieux Morehouse, throws off the cloak of illness and appears attired in the height of fashion, a checkered suit with a pearl-gray waistcoat, derby and spats to match, all designed for the racetrack, showed that Rogers got as much fun out of wearing fancy clothes as did his audiences at seeing him arrayed in all his glory. Will overcame his reputed aversion to evening dress and appeared in a faultlessly cut suit and a silk topper. All this went to prove that Will Rogers was a superb showman who clung to his careless manner of dress because it was his trademark and the finest kind of show business. In Business and Pleasure, Rogers was again called upon to play the part of a businessman, while in the play Ambassador Bill, he was a politician. Although there was nothing that savored of the Old West, he was allowed to just be Will Rogers, and the pictures Happy Days. He was a plutarchic businessman in Down to Earth, but in his next vehicle, Too Busy to Work, he was a happy-go-lucky tramp. Next, he played the role of a farmer who specialized in hog raising in State Fair, and in Dr. Bill, he was a country doctor. Will was the proprietor of a fix-it shop in Mr. Skitch, and in David Harum, he was a banker and a horse trader. An actor of rare talent. Rogers, despite all his fun-making, was an emotional actor of rare talent. It used to be one of the favorite and moss-covered jokes of the stage that the low comedian always aspired to the role of the melancholy Dane. Rogers proved that it takes a great comedian to play an emotional part. During the filming of Judge Priest, he played the leading part in Ah, Wilderness on the stage, and when the show opened in San Francisco, he was accorded one of the greatest ovations ever given a star in that city. His performance of the sympathetic role, created by that other great comedian, George M. Cohen, was acclaimed by the dramatic critics as one of the outstanding triumphs of the stage. Rogers said that after all his years of comedy, he essayed the role in Ah, Wilderness as a personal experiment, and he really felt that he might be a notable flop. Frank Borzage, who directed Will Rogers in They Had to See Paris and Young as You Feel, expressed the idea very clearly. The one thing that made Will Rogers the outstanding comedian in the films was his own ability to make audiences forget that he was a comedian. This quality of his was very apparent in the scenes where Rogers was called upon to portray the simple human emotions that touched the very soul of mankind. The sincerity and conviction with which he did them is what might be expected of a great tragedian. Audiences forget Rogers as a wisecracker and think of him only as a human being torn with emotion. Rogers' death in the Arctic cut short a production schedule of 10 proposed pictures for the Fox Company. The humorist had signed to appear in 10 pictures at a salary of $200,000 each and had completed 3 of them. The 3 completed pictures were Steamboat Round the Bend, Doubting Thomas, both released shortly before the tragedy, and In Old Kentucky. There was some question raised about the propriety of releasing Rogers' pictures after his death. David Butler, motion picture director, who knew Will as the working man better probably than any other person, told this question. Rogers was deeply affected by the deaths of Newt Rockne, football coach at Notre Dame, and Marie Dressler, the film star. "You know, Dave," Butler recalled Rogers as saying when they were talking about Miss Dressler, "there is a permanent record of her on these talking pictures, and she'll always be with us. Don't worry, old Will himself will always be there, too, unless they get tired of me." Dressing room, a rumple seat. Will's dressing room was a rumple seat of his car, and many times he would come tearing up to the stage in his car or on location where we were working. If he'd be late, he'd yell, "Hold on there, boys, I'm coming." He'd jump out of his car, dash around the back, and don his pants and shirt, and in a second, he would be ready for work. He would never sleep in his dressing room, as the other stars did. He'd hitch those old spectacles on at the end of his nose, slide down into a chair, his face hidden in a newspaper, pretending he was reading. But he would be snoozing. After a while, I would go over and tap him, and he would awaken with a jerk, clear his throat, and say, "Look here, Dave. Did you read this story in the paper? Plum interesting." Butler declared that Rogers disliked learning the lines as written in the scenario. He would have Butler give him the general theme of the scene, and then the humorist would supply many of his own lines. Seldom did Rogers ask that the mechanical crew on his set work overtime, but whenever a picture was completed ahead of schedule, the comedian would make up the loss to the men by paying them out of his own pocket. In all, he made 19 talking pictures. None of them earned less than $1 million at the box office, and it has been estimated that he brought in more than $25 million to the treasury of the Fox Company while he was in their employ. On the movie lots in Hollywood, everyone loved Will Rogers, and nobody was jealous of him, which was, by the way, of being a miracle when the temperament of movie stars was considered. no upstage for Rogers. Never did he demand anything as the highest salaried star in the business. He spent half his time gabbling with the $5 and $10 a day extras. Often they were just a tryout audience for some wisecrack that would appear in the next day in his daily writings or as a gag in his pictures. Scorned luxurious dressing room. While he talked, he chewed, sometimes gum, but mostly rubber bands or the tips of his spectacles. He claimed that 18 pairs of spectacles were chewed up every 2 years. Overall, high-heeled cowboy boots and an old sweater was his usual costume about the movie lots. He looked more like a cowhand than the greatest star. Rogers had the only reserved table in the commissary on the Fox lot. He invariably drank 2 cups of coffee, regardless of what he ate, and always paid the checks of all those who sat at his table. He scorned a luxurious dressing room. The studio fixed an adobe hut in the midst of a beautiful garden for him to occupy. The place had an electric kitchen and a living room adorned with Western and Indian trophies. Rogers looked in and said, "It is swell," and never went back until President and Mrs. Coolidge visited him. He ushered them into the house and later explained it by saying, "Well, they had to set somewheres, didn't they?" Every year, Henry Ford and Walter Chrysler presented Rogers with a new roadster or coupe, and he used it for an office and a dressing room. In the rumple seat, he kept 12 ties, 2 suits of clothes, and a portable typewriter. That was his movie and literary equipment. When he was not working or eating in the company of restaurant, he would generally be found seated upon the running board of his automobile with his typewriter on his lap, writing a piece for the papers. Rogers' love of people. He was always on time, and after he had the action of the scene to be photographed thoroughly in his mind, he would ask what clothes he was to wear. Then he would go to his car, pick out a tie, or perhaps change a suit. Then he would work until noon, when he would call out, "Lunchy!" That was a signal for a dash to the restaurant, and he would be the first one there. His love of food was equaled only by his desire to travel and meet people. Rogers called the restaurant his club, and often he toured the room, stopping to chat for a moment with stenographers, script girls, extras, and others who earned only modest salaries. After passing the time of day with them, he would pick up their checks and pay for their lunches. When he was out on location, Will took a box lunch along and sat down with the mechanics, carpenters, and extras to eat it. When he returned to the set after luncheon, Rogers always took a half hour or more to grind out his daily newspaper feature. This finished, he would read it to the stage carpenter or a director. If their reaction was good, it would be sent at once to the telegraph office. About 4:30 every afternoon, Rogers would begin spinning imaginary ropes as a signal to the director that he was impatient to be off for his Santa Monica ranch to rope a few steers, a pastime which he never tired. Once he was playing in a scene in a late afternoon, and it was decided to continue it after supper. The action called for Rogers to take the same place as before. The camera was aimed at the back of his head. As they were about to shoot the scene, the director noticed to his horror that Rogers had his hair cut during the supper hour. The director explained to Rogers that it would be ridiculous to see long hair 1 minute and short hair the next. The picture was spoiled, he assured Rogers. Will grinned. Shucks, he said. If it's a good picture, they won't notice it, and if it's a bad, it won't matter. Rogers had very strict ideas of what he would do for the moving pictures. He wouldn't portray smoking or drinking, although he did not mind if other characters did it in his picture when such action was necessary to the plot. In Doubting Thomas, Will was supposed to take a cigar from his pocket and hand it to another player. He refused on the ground that he didn't smoke and the action would be unlike him. Visitors to Fox movie lots always asked to see Will Rogers first. If those making the request were prominent enough, they were presented to him, and during his career in Movie Tone City, he entertained more celebrities than any of the others in Hollywood's royal families. A list of the notables were called upon him once would read like a selection of names from the front pages of the newspapers. While he was engaged in filming Business and Pleasure, he was visited by Patrick J. Hurley, then Secretary of War, Colonel and Mrs. Charles Lindbergh, David Ingalls, Secretary of Aeronautics for the Navy, Helen Wills, the tennis queen, Frank Hawks, the aviator, Florence Ziegfeld, Prince Svasti of Siam, and his royal family, the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame football fame, and scores of others equally well known. Instead of taking the callers through the plant in his own car, Rogers took great delight in offering them the novelty of the studio's private transportation system. This was a bus with a uniformed driver. Luncheon was sometimes served in his dressing room. It was a mystery to many at the studio how a man who neither drank, smoked, played cards, golf, nor tennis could enjoy his fame as a host. The secret was in his conversational ability. Rogers even talked to himself, a habit that probably carried over from his cowboy days on the Oklahoma range. A weekend guest at the Rogers Ranch was a three-day show, with Rogers keeping up as a running fire of Western political, Hollywood, and darky stories. One of his unrealized ambitions was to make a picture in blackface. Rogers' death cut short a proposed production schedule of 10 pictures for the Fox 20th Century Company he had signed to appear in the films until 1938. Steamboat Round the Bend, which was released just about the time he died, was hailed by critics everywhere as probably his greatest picture. The character, as always, was Will Rogers, the movie actor, who in 1934 and 1935 was rated as the player who had drawn the largest number of patrons to the movie houses of the country. In the picture, Will again showed his rare ability of timing his scenes perfectly, of modulating his voice in the exact tone, and of emphasizing the humor with a spontaneity that made it appear as if acting were fun instead of the hardest kind of work. Irvin S. Cobb, who played with him in the picture, tells how Rogers magnanimously gave Anne Shirley, the pretty young actress who played the lead, her chance to shine in one of the important scenes. Cobb, the famous humorist and writer, was induced to play in the picture at the insistence of Rogers. Cobb told how Will drew John Ford, the director, aside during a lull in the play. "John," Rogers said, "this kid is good. She's swell. And she's a sweet little thing, off and on. Makes me think of my own Mary somehow. What say, let her dominate the scene instead of me?" Ford, according to Cobb, told Rogers that he was the star, and Will replied, "I'm getting the star's billing and the star's salary, but the star of this picture, man or woman, is the one that can steal it. Have a heart, John. Give the kid a chance." And John had a heart, Cobb declared.